We are happy that our next speaker is one of our faculty members. Paolo De Luca was born in Milan, Italy, raised in Ferrara, Italy. I probably will be corrected on those pronunciations. Moved to the United States in 2006 and received his U.S. citizenship in 2010. Since 2007, he has served the Bridge Street Church of Christ in New Martinsville, West Virginia, about 30 minutes south of here, as a pulpit minister, and since 2009, he has served as one of her elders. He is an instructor at the West Virginia School of Preaching, where he teaches the book of Romans along with the book of Galatians. Paolo is married to the former Cindy Inman, daughter of the late Clifton and Pauline Inman. That whole family is very dear to the hearts of so many of us around this area. Clifton was a well-known preacher of the gospel for 50 years in the Ohio Valley. Paolo and Cindy reside in New Martinsville, West Virginia, and have one son, Marco, who received the master's degree in leadership from Freed Hardeman University and is now living in Los Angeles, California. Paolo may be I don't need to read that. Paolo is very special to us. He and his son, Marco, anytime they're outside and Cindy calls them into dinner, she says, Marco, Paolo. I had to do that. Just had to do it. I go places and I brag that we must be the only school of preaching that has an Italian teaching the epistle that was written to the Italians, Romans. You think about that. It means nothing, but I'm glad we do. And Paolo is very special to us, and he'll do us an excellent job at this hour. Paolo?
Thank you, Andy. With friends like you. I'm really thankful for the possibility to be here today, and I'm thankful for the time we can have together in studying this good book. With John, we had a plan, but he blew it. We planned that he was going to put everybody asleep. I was going to be very quiet and just let Charles finish up in a crescendo. But John did a really good job, and I'm pleased that he did that, because he set the tone pretty high for me to continue. We're going to look in Psalm 52. And the title that is being assigned to me is God Give Me Mercy. When I was in high school, it was very popular, a series of books by Arthur Bloch. These books were entitled Murphy's Laws. And as a student, I was caught in that. In fact, I didn't have much money at that time, but those books were in my beginning of library. Also, at that time, I was not really into reading. I was more into watching television, play video games, stuff like that. But those books fascinated me because of something that I thought that was so true. If anything can go wrong, it will. It will. And I thought as a student that that was my life. I didn't study. I go to school, take a test, and went bad. Can you believe it? If anything can go wrong, it will go wrong. And so I tried to get a more understanding of that. And I find out that if it seems too good to be true, it probably is. If everything seems to go well, obviously you have overlooked something. And the motto at that time was, smile, tomorrow will be worse than today. No matter how long or how hard you shop for an item, after you purchase it, it will be on sale somewhere cheaper. The chance of the bread falling with the buttered side down is directly proportional to the cost of the carpet. The light at the end of the tunnel will probably turn out to be the headlamp of an approaching freight train. I don't know about you, but I thought at that time that that was reality. Every time I was turning around, I could say, life is miserable and nothing is going to turn out right. Murphy's Law is named after a captain that was experimenting at the Edwards Air Force Base in California in 1949. And they were trying to come with some experiments, and there was an engineer that helped them to mess up completely and always. But this is not the very beginning of the Murphy's Law. In reality, in 1866, somebody already formulated something like this. It is found that anything can go wrong at sea, generally does go wrong sooner or later. Now, we have this concept that life has to be always something pleasant, something good. And we have, and we are grown, and we keep on having this misconception that if things don't go our way, it is some miserable thing. When we talk about mercy, mercy is a very important subject in the Bible and in all our lives. Let me give you a modern parable of mercy before we get into the Bible. The American B-17 pilot during World War II, flying over Germany, had been in a severe fight. His plane was damaged. A lot of the crew were wounded or even dead. And he is trying to come out of Germany toward the ocean, and suddenly he looked on his left, and he blinked hard, and looked again, he thought, oh my, this is a nightmare. And he talked to the co-pilot, and he pointed to a German airplane that was flying next to them, and he says, we are doomed. He is going to destroy us. The man looked very intensely to the great German Messerschmitt as they were flying, hoping to go home for Christmas. It was only 5 days before Christmas 1943. The crippled American B-17 had a hard time to stay in the air. The pilot of the B-17, by the name of Charles Brown, was a 21 years old West Virginia farm boy on his first combat mission. His bomber has been shot to pieces by the swarming fighters, and his plane was alone, struggling to stay in the skies above Germany. His aim was to cross the sea and land in England. Half of his crew was wounded. The tail gunner was dead in his position. And when Brown and his co-pilot, Spencer Pinky Luke, look at the fighter pilot, the German pilot again, they knew that they were not gonna see another day. The German surprised them because he did not pull the trigger. Instead, as he flew near them, he decreased the speed, and he tried to signal them something. What happened was that Franz Steigler, the German pilot, looking at the damage of the American aircraft, had mercy on them. A few hours before, he was on the ground with his buddies, and he was talking about these evil devils of Americans. His brother was killed by American bombs the week before. So when they heard the noise of the B-17 fly low over their head, he volunteered to go and bring him down. He jumped on his aircraft looking to get the final hit that would give him the Knight Cross, the German highest award for valor. And after his brother August has been killed, he was another Luftwaffe pilot, he was all aim to bring down that plane. So as he flies from behind, he sees that something is wrong, and he looks better, and he sees the damage of the plane. At that point, he decided to help the enemy. He started a signal that they should have landed, and he was going to direct them over the Sweden airspace. And you know, that is subject to martial law. His job was to kill the enemy. And instead, he was going to bring them to a safe land. But the pilots of the B-17 could not understand what he wanted. And so they kept on going toward England. So Steigler decided, I will fly below them so that the machine guns from the ground will not hit them because I'm protecting them. And he went all the way to the coast. And at the coast, he flew back on the side. He saluted them and he said to himself, good luck. You are in God's hands now. You know, God's mercy is important in our study, in our lives. And we are always amazed when we can recount examples of human mercy, like Steigler had for the B-17. In the Bible, I believe, there is a parable that Jesus told us that could be probably the most essential teaching on mercy that we can ever find. It is the Good Samaritan story. You all remember the victim of the story was in a very miserable condition. He had been beaten, robbed, and left on the side of the road, believed to be dead. The priest, the Levite, come by and show no concern for him, but they were worried about themselves. Then next comes a Samaritan. And Luke chapter 10, verse 33 says, as he journeyed, came where he was. And when he saw him, he had compassion. The original language gives us the term mercy as a word that conveys strong feelings of pity, sympathy, compassion, and affection. Sometimes in the Bible, we have this term that is translated with loving kindness. Another word that describes the mercy of God as he looks to the suffering of people. As that pilot was looking to the suffering of the B-17 and decides to do something because of love, tenderness, kindness toward the people that are in need. When we read that God is merciful, we are assured not just of his feelings, but of his actions because of his feelings. And the mercy of God is something that we need to learn to apply in our lives, because it is not enough to feel unless we take action. This is what we can find out from the Samaritan. In Luke chapter 10, verse 34 and 35, we are told that he went to him when he saw the man that has been beaten and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. And he set him on his own animal, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. On the next day, when he departed, he took out 2 denarii, gave them to the innkeeper, and said to him, "Take care of him, and whatever more you spend, when I come again, I will repay you." David never heard this parable, because Jesus is going to say this many centuries after David is gone. But David talks so much about the mercy of God in many different of his psalms. We don't have now the time to go through, and somebody else will do, Psalm 136. In this psalm, the mercy of God is named in all 26 verses with this ritual sentence: "His mercy endures forever." And it is really profitable for us to know and to remember the fact that mercy has not to be confused with grace. Mercy is different from grace, because grace emphasizes the assistance to the undeserving, while mercy emphasizes the relief to the unfortunate. This is something that, for me, is important, because God gives his loving attitude in many different ways. When David found himself in one of the most difficult times of his life, he pens Psalm 52. And when he writes Psalm 52, he has in his mind the mercy of God. Let's give a little history of what is happening. It is the moment in which David is has heard about the action of Doeg the Edomite. Doeg was one of Saul's chief shepherds, 1 Samuel chapter 21, verse 7. The old king was chasing David, trying to kill him. Doeg informs Saul that David has been going to Ahimelech, the priest at Nob, and that he has been helped by Ahimelech, and that he received the provisions that are needed, and even Goliath's sword. At this point, Doeg is trying to find favor with Saul. Saul goes there, charges Ahimelech with conspiracy, and orders his guards to kill Ahimelech and all his family. The guards refuse, recognizing that it would be sinful to raise their hand against the anointed servants of the Lord. So Saul orders Doeg to kill Ahimelech and his family. What this man do? It's unbelievable. In 1 Samuel chapter 22, verse 18 and 19, so Doeg the Edomite turned and struck the priest and killed on that day 85 men who wore the linen ephod. Also Nob, the city of the priests, he struck with the hedge of the sword, both men and women, children and nursing infants, oxen and donkeys, and sheep with the edge of the sword. David comes to know this, and his heart is broken. He feels so miserable. He needed help, and he was able to receive help. But how many people paid for helping David? How many holy people of God met death because of a wicked man? The reaction that David has is described in Psalm 52. In the first section, from verse 1 to verse 4, he is talking about the wickedness of this man. And he is wondering, how in the world can you be so proud? Why do you boast in evil, almighty man? It sounds almost sarcastic, the mighty man. If you are so good that you are willing to raise your sword and kill innocent people, and among these innocent people, there were people that were servants of God, his priests, how in the world are you willing to boast? If you are so mighty, why don't you look for what is good? What dog has done is a horrible evil. And as bad as his action had been, it is even worse that he was going around being a proud man of what he did. Of course, he was trying to get the favor of Saul. But he got a perversity. He got a wicked reputation. The wicked man is quick with his tongue. In fact, in verse 2 and 4, your tongue devises destruction like a sharp razor working deceitfully. You love all devouring words, your deceitful tongue. The wicked person not only is not smart enough to hide the evil actions that he's doing, and he goes around bragging, hoping that other people will clap their hands and say, yeah, you are a good man. But he's dedicated to a evil, sharp tongue. The words that he speaks, they're always showing who he is. In fact, James will say, but no man can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil, full of deadly poison. With it, we bless our God and Father, and with it, we curse men who have been made in the similitude of God. Out of the same mouth proceed blessing and cursing, my brethren. These things ought not to be so. James chapter 3, verse 8 to 10. A third characteristic of the evil man that David is proclaiming as he works through the prayer is that he loves evil. It's not just that he does things without understanding what he's doing, or he does things because of ignorance. He loves evil. In verse 3, he says, you love evil more than good, lying rather than speaking righteousness. The wicked person finds joy in evil, loves speaking bad about other people. In Jeremiah chapter 4, verse 22, the prophet says, they are wise to do evil, but to do good, they have no knowledge. The wicked man, David is picturing him as a very perverted person, proud, sharp tongue, and lover of evil. And as he goes through in his reflection, and as he continues to ponder on God's love, mercy, and action, and you have noticed he hasn't talked about mercy yet, it's coming, he takes the center section of Psalm 52 to talk about how the wicked person will end. It is important to know that total ruin is reserved to such a person. In verse 5, David describes the everlasting ruin that is going to come on the wicked people. God shall likewise destroy you forever. He shall take you away and pluck you out of your dwelling place and uproot you from the land of the living. The wicked people, they might demand to sit in the best seats. They might demand to be treated as they do not deserve. But this is only on this earth. This is only for this life. Because the mercy of God is going to intervene. As John told us in the lesson before, that the man of God might be defeated, but at the end will be victorious. David says, the wicked will never win. In verse 6 and 7, he affirms, the righteous also shall see and fear and shall laugh at him, saying, here is the man who did not make God his strength, but trusted in the abundance of his riches and strengthened himself in his wickedness. These words are a clear element. This is what you are going to get. This is all that you can enjoy. And if you are a wicked one, enjoy your life here, because it's not going to last. If you want to be proud of yourself, if you are not afraid of how you speak, if you are not concerned on how you hurt people, your brothers, your sisters, how you are lacking to fear God and respect his law, it's better you enjoy this land. It's better you have a lot of fun in this life. And he comes to the conclusion of his thinking. Verse 8 and 9 of Psalm 52. David comes with the understanding that the righteous are strong, even if they seem weak. They are fruitful, even if the man, the human vision that they acquire from other people is like they are defeated. In fact, he says, and remember, David is feeling bad because of what happened in Nob. He is feeling bad about being in some way the reason why Ahimelech and his people are dead now. He feels bad because Doeg has success in front of Saul. And he says in verse 8, "But I am like a green olive tree in the house of God." David compares himself to the strongest tree that there is. One of the trees that don't look really nice. If you have seen an olive tree that is 300-400 years old, 500 years old, you don't go say, "Oh, what a beautiful tree." No. Most of those will be short, will be all complex, the trunk will be with a lot of bumps, and it doesn't look nice. But it's always fruitful. And olives are always coming in season. And it's going to last for hundreds of years. And David says, in the house of the Lord. Have you noticed that? He's not talking outside the house of the Lord. He says, in the house of the Lord, I am like one of those trees. You can beat me. You can hurt me. You can tear me down. I won't look nice. You won't look at me with those eyes of expectation. I'm going to be like a ragged tree. But I will be strong and I will be fruitful. Not for you, for God. How is that possible? How can I do that? In the second part of verse 8, David tells us, "Because I trust in the mercy of God forever and ever." David knows that he is like that B-17. He's been hit. He's wounded. There are skeletons in his life. There are things that if he could go back, he'll do completely different. And he knows that he does not deserve God's mercy. But nobody deserved that mercy. You cannot do anything to have that mercy. God is going to take action because of how he looks at you and he sees that you are miserable because of your sin, because of your wrong choices, because of the things that you have done in disobedience of his word. And that's why in verse 9 he says, "I will praise you forever." Let us notice also the fact that he already said in verse 8, forever and ever. Now, not only I'll be strong because I have trust in the mercy of God that will last forever, I will do something forever now. I will not be only receive your mercy forever, I will praise you forever because you have done it. Because you have given me mercy. Because you have looked to my situation and you have given me the action of your love, your compassion, and your care. Finally, David is going to give us probably the best suggestion that a man of God can give when he talks about himself, when he talks about the things that he struggles with, when he talks about the violence that he had to be under. At the end of verse 9, he says, "And in the presence of your saints, I will wait on your name, for it is good." The righteous man does not keep his faith hidden. He doesn't live isolated because of the bad, evil action of people like Doeg. He is going to stick around with the holy people of God, with your saints, I will be. In the presence of them, I will be the example that I will wait on you, God. Because even if I don't see it right now, your action, I know, is coming. Even if right now it seems that Murphy's Law is true, that everything that can go wrong is going even worse, I know that you are going to show me your mercy. I am reminded of Psalm 37, verse 7. Be still before the Lord. Wait patiently for him. Charles Spurgeon, you've heard a lot of him in these lessons, and you will hear, because he is one of those authors, that one of those scholars of the Bible that wrote one of the masterpieces on the Psalms. And he writes about Psalm 52, "Before or among the saints, David intended to wait, feeling it to be good both for him and them to look to the Lord alone and to wait for the manifestation of his character in due season. Men must not too much fluster us. Our strength is to sit still. Let the mighty one boast. We will wait on the Lord. And if their haste brings them present honor, our patience will have its turn by and by, and bring us the honor which excelleth." Psalm 27, verse 14. "Wait for the Lord. Be strong and let your heart take courage. Wait for the Lord." Solomon spoke about this waiting of the Lord. David spoke again about this in Psalm 103. Moses pleaded with God in Numbers 14 in the situation of Kadesh Barnea to forgive the people. Daniel in Daniel chapter 9 verse 49 prayed for the forgiveness of his people. Jeremiah in Lamentation 3:22, affirms about the compassion that God should have for his people. When we consider the biblical teaching on mercy, it is not surprising that David, in one of the darkest moments of his life, In the moment in which he hears the evil of Doeg, proclaims, "I trust in the mercy of God forever and ever." David knows very well that his God is the God of mercy. In Psalm 59, it is said, "My God of mercy shall come to meet me. To you, my strength, I will sing praises, for God is my defense, my God of mercy." And what better way to close our study here in this hour together with the words of Psalm 23. "Surely, goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." Thank you very much.